Hi, welcome. My name is Amy MacDonald, and I'm the chair of Penn New England, and Penn New England is so proud to be sponsoring this panel, All Masters of the Short Story. We have four of New England's literary treasures with us and one certified genius. I was going to say Edith Perlman. But we also want to welcome and are so proud to have Jennifer Haig and Juno Diaz. And Juno, congratulations.
Is that us? All right. I want to welcome you all to the first session of the day, at least for us, the short story session. And my name is Christina Thompson. I'm the editor of Harvard Review. You can't hear me? Well, that's for the audio people. How's that? Is that better? Okay. So my name is Christina Thompson. I'm the editor of Harvard Review. I'm going to be moderating the panel, and I'm going to give you a brief CV for each of the panelists. And then we're going to begin with some questions and some chat. And then I hope at the end we'll have time for questions from the audience. And if you want to give me an idea when that's a good time to start, that'd be great. So we have three very prominent and important and wonderful local writers, which is wonderful for us here in Boston. Juno Diaz is a professor, writer, and Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. He is the author of Drown and The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2008, and also the just-published collection of short stories, This Is How You Lose Her. His stories have been published in The New Yorker, African Voices, Best American Short Stories, Pushcart Prize, O. Henry Stories. He's won many awards and fellowships, including the 2002 Penn Malamud Award, Fellowship at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, the American Academy of Arts and Letters Rome Prize, and, of course, the coveted MacArthur Award. Diaz currently is the fiction editor at the Boston Review and the Nancy Allen Professor at MIT. In the middle, Jennifer Haig is a novelist and short story writer. Her first novel, Mrs. Kimball, won the Penn Hemingway Award for debut fiction. Her second novel, Baker Towers, won the 2006 Penn L.L. Winship Award for an outstanding book by a New England author. Jennifer Haig's short stories have been featured in The Atlantic, Granta, the Saturday Evening Post. Her most recent novel is called Faith, and her first collection of short stories, which will be published in January, is called News from Heaven. And immediately to my left, Edith Perlman is the author of, I love this detail, 250 works of short fiction and nonfiction, which have been published in literary journals, anthologies, and online publications. Her work has appeared in Best American Short Stories, the O. Henry Prize Collection, Pushcart Prize, New York Times, Plowshares, and many other places. Perlman was awarded the Drew Hines Prize for Literature for her first collection of stories, Vaquita. Her second collection, Love Among the Greats, won the Spokane Annual Fiction Prize. Her latest collection, Binocular Vision, was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the National Books Critics Circle Award. So now we have the business out of the way. So I thought the first thing we ought to do is we ought to try and locate our authors in time and space, sort of culturally. And I thought that we might begin on a kind of a personal note by asking each of them to talk a little bit about themselves and about, particularly, about the social and historical and political context out of which their stories arise and the world that they write about and how that relates to the world that they either grew up in or the world that they live in now. And I think we will have each person answer this question, and then after that we won't go each person every time because it gets a little tiresome. So Edith, maybe you could start.
I think I'm located in the world of jewelry because I get a number of awards as being a writer who influences American Jews, is a good influence on American Jews, I should say. I was surprised at the first such award, since I think of myself as an American writer, not as a writer, nothing more specific. But that is where I am located, and indeed I have a Jewish background and write a number of stories with Jewish themes, Jewish people, Jewish misgivings, all the things that Jews suffer and enjoy. I'm also located in the 20th century, more than the 21st. I think that's about it.
Okay. My mind has been racing trying to think of an answer to this question. I think sometimes writers are the worst at characterizing where we fit in the grand scheme of things. I'm not quite sure where I fit socially or culturally. Those are not things I think about when I'm writing. In general, I write the stories that fascinate me, and I write out of a curiosity about people. I think fundamentally, I want to know what people are like from the inside in the way that we can only know ourselves. And when you're writing fiction, you get to know all your characters in that very intimate way. So I write the stories that compel me. You know, I write the short stories and books that I want to read. And, you know, it's not much of an answer, but it's what I've got.
It's an answer.
Yeah, I'm a Dominican immigrant. Yeah, I think. Can you hear me? I think it's off. Let's try fix it. No.
I will loan you mine.
Well, very kind. One more shot at this.
Here, let me give you mine. Oh, I can't. It's all the way down there.
Well, that's right.
I'd have to undress.
Yeah, yeah. Straight down our back.
Yeah, somebody will have to come and help you. All right.
Oh, very kind.
You could speak to me and I could relay your words.
Yeah, I think they're bringing one.
Does this work now? Yeah, very kind. I guess swiftly, I'm a Dominican immigrant. Well, we got some Dominicans right here. Where are you guys from? You're from Baní and La Capital. Oh, thank you for coming out, you guys. It's so nice, and they're right up front, man. Yeah, so I'm a Dominican immigrant, and if you can generalize from being one person out of a 10 million person diaspora, I wish you luck. Yeah? I think that is a category that contains absolute multitudes. Though I think a lot of us use these categories as shorthands. Perhaps one way to answer the question is that I, as a writer, came up being an obsessive reader. And the 99.99% of the stuff I read sounded like no one I grew up with. When I think of my context as a writer is that I am of that huge group of people in any language that are almost entirely unrepresented. And or even generationally, I belong to a community of people that not only haven't been represented, but have been completely just sort of fundamentally distorted. When you see representations of people of the kind that I grew up with, people almost entirely misunderstand what we're doing or what we're saying and who we are. And we tend to get limited to discussions about our language, which is hilarious because as a writer, you use language to try to get at deeper themes. Yeah, and so I think of those things, you know, you know, between my love of writing, my love of reading, and the absolute silence which the community that I grew up lives in, I think that a lot of that can explain part of my project and part of what I do, what I'm interested in doing.
I was afraid you guys would all resent my asking you about your backgrounds because nobody wants to be pigeonholed as the writer of this and writer of that, and it happens in the publishing universe. But let's talk about form. Let's talk about some really strict issues of form now instead of who you are. There was, all these writers have been in Best American Short Stories, and Edith and Jennifer are both in the current edition, which I'm just going to hold up, which is this one. And the editor of that edition was Tom Perotta. You know, they have a guest editor every issue, and that was Tom Perotta this year. And I want to borrow a page from Tom's introduction, excuse me, because I thought he raised a really interesting question about the form over time. So we want to think about the form sort of historically for a moment. Perotta talks about the tremendous influence of Raymond Carver in the postmodernist period, so sort of from the 70s forward. And he describes, Perotta that is, describes the experience of going back and reading, or of reading through all of the stories that come in for Best American Short Stories in relationship to his memories, really, of being an MFA candidate and a young writer in the shadow of the great Raymond Carver. And he said that what was really astonishing to him was that there was not a single story that came across his desk that exemplified the kind of stories that he was used to, or at least that he remembered from the 80s. In those kinds of stories, he said, back then you had your main character, you had your central event or situation, and that was that. And he said that the stories that came across his desk for this project of looking at all of the stories that were published in the last year, that these stories had multiple perspectives, they ranged across great stretches of time, and he describes one of them as having, I thought this was a great line, smuggled the full range of novelistic technique into the writing of short fiction. So what I want to ask is really not so much whether you think your own writing smuggles the full range of novelistic technique into the short fiction, although kind of interesting, but also to think back historically over the short story over time, and whether you think that, in fact, the short story has changed, whether the form of the short story has somehow morphed or grown or altered or something, if what the classic is in your mind, and whether that's something that... Jennifer?
I think it has changed. I think it's constantly changing. And I think my own work has changed. I'm not even talking about the short story in a global way. When I look at stories I wrote 10 years ago, they're formally so different from what I find interesting now. So I think that's what is exciting about the short story as a form. It is incredibly dynamic. And, you know, I'm a novelist as well as a short story writer. I spend 3 years writing a novel. I make these sort of stylistic and aesthetic choices, and then I live with them for 3 years. When you're writing a short story, it's a shorter gestation period. It's a shorter growth cycle. So you can do more different things in rapid succession.
With different stories.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Edith, what do you think about this?
Well, my ideal of the short story is the fairy tale, which is where I began reading, and I continue to write. The fairy tale is circumscribed by place and point of view. The point of view is the author rather than the character. But to me, it is the ideal, and I notice that many stories today have a kind of fabulous quality. They may bring in all novelistic methods, but there is often a point in the story where something happens that is not expected and actually not probable. Following the fairy tale. I like that.
I don't think that's what he had in mind, but that's a really interesting idea. He had the return of the fable. What do you think? Do you think the stories have changed?
Well, I mean, I guess I come at this approach as a reader, first and foremost.
Yeah.
And I always find, like, I'm always really cautious about those generalizations because I read obsessively, and I think most writers do, and I can safely say that I've read 1% of the short stories, probably less, that are available in any given year. And that, for example, I couldn't say that I read, you know, maybe 0.001%. And so it seems like a weird place to generalize from. And there's so much stuff that's happening in other genres. Like if you guys read science fiction, if you read horror, you know, I mean, romance, the amount of romance short stories that are generated dwarf anything that's being generated in literary fiction. And so I always think that these are kind of weird. They're more arguments of authorial ethos than they are about what's happening on the ground, because the pattern is almost unrecognizable unless you would read at least two-thirds of what's going on. So for any argument that I could make about a short story, I could find 20,000 stories that go against it.
So let's talk about authorial ethos then. What's your authorial ethos?
I mean, I think what's interesting for me when I think about what's going on with the short stories is I think that anybody who loves to read short stories, it couldn't be in a better time. I think that there could not be a better time. If you're interested in whatever kind of short story you're interested in, you're going to find a ton of people at practicing the form at a top level. It's an extraordinary time to be interested in the short story.
I think maybe that's part of what he meant, actually, was that there was a great breadth and depth and variety, and that the form of the story was now sort of had been kind of multiplied in a way, that there were many different kinds of things. What do you guys like to read? Short story writers do you like to read? Edith, who do you like to read?
I like to read Colette, who is not writing now.
Unless in some secret place that we don't know about.
With Tupac.
I like to read Sylvia Townsend Warner, who also is not writing now, but did write rather recently. I like to read the two people I'm sharing the small table with.
It's a long list for me. And of people working right now, I think nobody is more interesting to me than Jim Shepherd. He writes these short stories that are whole worlds unto themselves. And as somebody who tries to write stories, I look at what he does and I think it would take me 15 years to come up with that idea, never mind to execute it. I think he's endlessly original and inventive, and really one of the best American writers working today. I love Muriel Spark, a writer who's no longer around. Was a complete master of the short story and completely underread, I think, in this country. I love William Trevor. I love Alice Munro. You know, it's in fact, a lot of the writing that I'm most excited to read is in the short form.
Got some favorites that you like to read in the short story form?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there's so many people out there that you can sort of grab on and that are doing such really, really good work. I think the writer's name is Maureen McHugh. She did this group of really apocalyptic short stories. Was it called After Midnight? Does anybody know this? After the Apocalypse. Isn't that collection amazing? It's like extraordinary. And there's a young guy, his name is Paul Yoon. He wrote a book of short stories called Once the Shore, which was really, really remarkable. This young Korean-American writer, Chris Lee, she wrote Drifting House. Again, this book just came out a few months ago, but it's really kind of remarkable. And then, God, I don't know why, the last two days I haven't slept, but that really superb, I think one of the most perfect books of stories in the last few years, the writer's name, I don't know why it's failing me, it's the book is called The Story of Yours and Others. Do you guys know this? The name will come back to me, I'm sure, like, 4 weeks from now, but... Huh? Yes. Oh, my God, Ted Chiang. I'll never forgive myself. Say again? The Story of Your Life and Others. See? Even words get dropped from the title. But I promise, despite my, like, memories, is really probably the most perfect collection of stored stories, Ted Chiang. And it's science fiction, and he's killing it.
Is there anything that any of you don't like to read while you're writing? I mean, some people read for inspiration while they're writing. Some people avoid things while they're writing for fear of excessive influence or out of pure anxiety, I think, or I don't know what. Anything you avoid reading or like to read specifically when you're working on something?
Oh, that's a great question. I've when you're a young writer, you'll go hear other writers talk. And I remember when I was at my MFA program at Cornell, and we had all these readings, and the whole time the readings were going on, like, it was just the luck of the draw, but all the writers that we had in those years, all of them said, like, while I'm while I'm writing, I try not to read too much. Yeah. And I'm kind of like the opposite. I mean, writing is just an excuse for me to read, you know? And I totally don't give a crap if other people's voices are in my head. I'm like, I do not consider myself very original. I think most people are not. And so I don't mind the hand of other books on my shoulders pushing me along. But I guess perhaps it's I less fetishize originality and authenticity, and I'm far more interested in like any strategy that'll help me get to the end of the story. But again,
theft, for example, being one good one.
Well, I mean, it helped all the greats.
Yeah, no kidding.
Theft really helps them. Yeah. It just seems like a weird thing to hold your breath when breath is the thing you need, or you sort of need stories to finish a story, and you sort of deny yourself stories, but to each their own, you know?
Oh, thanks.
No, I mean, to each their own.
Edith, do you have things that you avoid reading or like to read?
I'm like Juno. I read as much as I can while I'm writing and while I'm not writing, and I do steal.
Who do you steal from?
I steal from John Updike occasionally.
Yes.
I have stolen from Rebecca West, who is a wonderful writer, also not read much today. I've stolen from Salman Rushdie, and I think I better not go on.
Okay, Jennifer, let's start with who you steal from.
I don't ever knowingly steal, but I won't claim that I never unknowingly steal. There's nobody I'm afraid to read when I'm writing. I have no superstition around that. There are, I do try and, I try and read stuff that humbles me. And, you know, it's kind of a fine line, because when you read a book that is so awe-inspiring that it makes you think you need to pack it in and, you know, go to a good trade school and find another line of work, that's maybe not altogether helpful. Mm. But I'm drawn to the books that completely humble me and sort of remind me not just where the bar is, but why I ever wanted to do it in the first place.
Mm. Mm. One of the things that, you know, we talk about how there is so much great short fiction out there, which I think is absolutely true, and I think it makes the job of people who are trying to edit these anthologies really tricky. But there's also a huge amount of not-so-great short fiction being written. There's a lot of fiction being written, a lot of fiction being written. So one of the things I am kind of interested in, partly, I suppose, because in my capacity as an editor, I sort through a lot of stuff, and I see a lot of stuff that's pretty good, and then not so much that's just the next step up. And one of the things that happens a lot is when we have groups of readers, or when we train younger readers, or whatever, that we have a general, quite easily, arrive at a general consensus on the stuff that's not so good, and even the stuff that's pretty good. And then when you get into the upper tier of the stuff that you actually think is pretty darn good, we get less consensus. And we immediately begin to get the introduction of kind of... Because at that point, I think subjectivity starts to play a big role in the decision-making. But I'm curious about what it is that you think makes a story really... That, you know, when somebody really nails it, what is that? What qualities? And I think you have to think in your mind in some way about specific stories, because it's hard to talk about this in the abstract. But without even mentioning the stories, if you can just think about some of the qualities, think about teaching a class. What are the qualities you would describe that you think really, really help bring a story up to that extra, that top level of energy? Edith?
I read a story in The New Yorker a few weeks ago by a young Pakistani writer whose last name is Hamid. He's written a novel as well. That story, I thought, was top of the line. And I think it was the details. I think his strength was in giving us details that we needed to live in the village that he was writing about, and not too many.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay.
Well, what I think I'm drawn to... My sort of automatic answer to this is stories that have a high truth quotient, where you're seeing something happen, you're seeing people behave in ways that reminds you hard of life. Having said that, I can be dazzled by stories that don't do that at all. I'm thinking of the great Jenny Egan story in The New Yorker, several months ago called Black Box. Did anybody read this? It's a knockout. It's the best thing I've read in The New Yorker in I don't know how many years. And it has none of the qualities I just described to you. It's a sci-fi story, and it's wildly inventive and surprising and original in its language. So none of the things I think I look for were present in that story, and yet it knocked me out completely. So I don't know what I like.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that the same way that an author has an ethos, I think different readers desire different things, and that there's a whole series, a multitude of contact points where someone can feel themselves utterly transported or utterly engaged or frightened, or the story opens up a space of deliberation, or a story suddenly allows them to confront their humanity. You know, people want sort of different things, and I think that what's fascinating is that the more you read, the larger your appetite or your palate gets. And so that, and it changes with time. And there's entire readerships. I mean, listen, guys, there's entire readerships in this country. If somebody is dealing with race, they immediately shut off. And there's entire readerships that if there's no race, they're like, this is science fiction nonsense. And I think that, you know, it's important to remember that the multiple realities that we all exist in. Sometimes we want stories that confirm our reality, and sometimes we want stories that distort them. And so that the interplay between narratives of recognition and narratives of estrangement, you know, I think that that's something that is worth taking into account as both a reader and a writer. That you can write stories of estrangement and totally knock people out. And then you could write stories of recognition where people feel very at safe, very at home, and still knock people out. And it's an amazing and mysterious thing, man.
Do you have that feeling, but you're talking about the sort of kind of deep message of the story. What about the surface of the story? Do you have that feeling that, certainly I have the feeling from time to time when I read things and I think, oh my God, such exquisite command of the language. You know, this is just somebody who really understands, it's like clay, you know, this is a person who really understands the medium. The language itself, just the language. Never mind what they're talking about. No, anybody have that feeling? Do you have that feeling? I'm sure you do.
Well, what is the feeling? When I find that, am I happy?
Yes.
Yes.
You're ecstatic.
Yes.
You're really happy.
Yes, very, very happy.
And then maybe, as you say, humbled. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So one of the things that short story writers, especially short story writers who are also novelists, always have to get asked, and I have to apologize for this, but I have to ask it, is what is the difference between writing a short story and writing a novel? Because it's interesting to other people, even though you've been asked too many times. And I'm going to start with you, Jennifer, because Edith is a writer of short stories only, which is another interesting thing. We'll get to that in a minute. So the short story and the novel, just, I don't know which way you want to answer it.
Well, the differences are many. The most obvious one, I suppose, is has to do with the compression of a short story. And having just finished my first collection of short stories after doing four novels, I go back to novel writing now with a different set of eyes. And I lean on the language more. I expect more from the sentence, because a sentence in a short story has to travel a very long way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a novelist, you can get kind of lazy and loose about sentence making because you got thousands of them. You know? and so they become less precious to you. When you're writing a short story, you know, every group of five words has to carry you part of the way through the story. So I've become much more rigorous in all my writing, I think, after having spent this intense period working on short stories. The other huge difference between short stories and novels is the experience of publishing them. For most of us, publishing short stories is... you know, it happens on a smaller scale than publishing a novel. There is generally less enthusiasm in the publishing world for short stories than for novels. And more, there are few places to publish stories. You know, compared to 50 years ago, the number of wide circulation magazines that publish short stories is really quite small. And the competition among writers to get into those pages is very keen. So, you know, it is challenging, it can be frustrating. The good news is that there are more interesting ways of publishing short stories now than there ever have been. I'm a person who's never had a lot of interest in the business of publishing, but just recently, I made my first experiment in publishing a story electronically only. And I did it with great reservation. I'm very attached to, you know, having paper to turn, pages to turn, the kind of physical properties of a book. But this is a story that was published by Byliner in e-version only, and it has been a total revelation to me. I can't believe how many readers this story has found. I'm bowled over by it. It's the kind of large audience I've sort of took for granted that I can only find with a novel. There are people out there who really do want to read short stories, and I think we just have to be more inventive in the ways we reach them.
Well, that's a great piece. That's a great suggestion, actually. Yeah, Gina?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really, especially if you guys are out there doing this, I think it's really useful to, in your process, sort of create operational definitions that are in no way authoritative. In other words, I mean, that's basically what I do when I think about short stories and I think about novels. I create little definitions that help me, but I don't think that they apply to everything. They're just good for me to work.
Like yeah? What? Like how?
Well, for example, I mean, I think about the fact that the short story can be perfect. I can, on the average traditional short story, I can hold every single word of the short story in my brain, in my active memory. I can take a shower and know when a single word might have to go. I can sit around and get my gas pumped and think, oh, this paragraph, I can sift this paragraph. Your brain is capable of holding the traditional short story's entire length, every piece of it. It is impossible for you to do so with a novel. And novels, part of what I think about my operational definition is while a short story's temptation is that it can be perfect, the novel's, you know, kind of what's interesting about a novel is that it can never be perfect. A novel, in my mind, again, this is not universal. I don't mean this to think this is true, but this is how it helps me work, is that a novel in many ways reflects the humanity that it attempts to somehow describe and recreate and rekindle, and a humanity which is imperfect, which is flawed, which forgets names of books by Ted Chiang, which makes errors, whose sentences are not perfect. I mean, what I love about the novel is that it absorbs and expresses so much of our imperfections and yet still creates this enormous experience. I mean, I, for one, and I have the different approach, I love going to novels so that I can have shitty sentences because shitty sentences are part of your experience.
Wow, there's a rationale I haven't heard before.
But it's not a rationale. I mean, it's not a rationale. If you read the way I do, read the novels that everybody says are so great. And I'll read you some sentences that none of my short story writers would permit in their books. But part of the gift and the majesty of a novel is that you encounter the human. And I think that the short story, for a form that I love completely, its ability to be perfect is strangely inhuman. What we call the compression, what we call the art, what we call the lyrical, nobody can sustain that. You approach me and speak perfectly beautiful sentences for 15 pages. You know, I mean, you've used a mnemonic, and there's something really powerful about the play of each. I think it's awesome that writing a novel, you have to depend on an enormous amount of trust. You have to trust your unconscious to generate the information. You have to trust your material that it's going to hold together. Short story doesn't require any trust.
Huh?
In a sense that I can remember every word. My conscious mind can be in every detail of the short story the way it can't be in a novel. There's no way your conscious mind can executive control a novel. It just doesn't happen that way. There's too much material. It's like you can only put 15 or 20 pages in your head at once. And a lot of what makes a novel beautiful is done by unconscious work, connections that your unconscious is making in the writing that you don't see or even have any ideas happening till much later. You know, I mean, it's remarkable how much happens outside of your waking mind in a novel.
That's probably happening in the short story, too.
But you can control and manipulate it.
But Why isn't there trust? I don't understand where trust has gone in the short story.
I guess what I mean by this question, by trust, perhaps our terms are being a little imprecise, is that to write a novel means that you have to let go of an enormous amount of control, because your unconscious has to do an enormous lot of work. If you're a super executive-minded person, a super controlling person, a novel becomes very, very difficult. Now, am I saying this is a universal? No. Am I saying this is for me? Yeah. And I think that the more I trust my material and the more I let things go, the more stuff happens. There's alchemy that if you trust your unconscious and you have a ton of training, a ton of skills, a ton of desires, your conscious mind is completely ready to go, but you give your unconscious mind the mood, the room to play without you constantly second-guessing it, crazy, wonderful stuff happens. I mean, in my, again, this is me. And it's great to have a book that you don't spend every second of the day. It can't be entirely in your brain. You've got to trust that it's holding together. With a short story, I can ride over every sentence. I could tell you if it's holding together. A novel, it's a lot harder, man.
Yeah. Edith, you have had a wonderfully long career writing short stories, lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of wonderful stories. Have you been tempted to write a novel ever? And if not, what's the thinking there?
I'm asked this question.
I know, sorry. Oh,
that's perfectly all right.
Apologies.
What is odd to me is that nobody ever says, why haven't you tried to write poetry?
Exactly.
I assume you have, actually.
But I think it is understood that poetry requires a compression, again, of a severe kind, that isn't required in the short story, and that a novel requires the kind of free association that Juno was describing, that is in the short story but is contained. So I think that they are three different genres. Jennifer, I'm sure, would disagree with me. But... So I am not tempted to write a novel, and I am not tempted to write a poem. I'm in my box.
But I like what you just said, though, about the order of hierarchy, that no one ever says, it's like the chain of being. No one ever says, well why don't you consider going down to be a badger? You know, it's always like the only way that you can ascend as a writer is possibly to do the novel.
Well, I think that this arises partly out of the publishing, the sort of strictures of the publishing industry. I mean, we don't operate in a vacuum. We don't operate in an idealized universe. We operate within a publishing universe, which has, you know, money changes hands and things like that happen. And as Jennifer mentioned earlier, this question about whether short stories are saleable, whether collections of short sales are marketable. And of course, publishers are notoriously reluctant to publish collections of short stories unless they know that you've got a novel coming to go with, or unless you are already a published novelist and this is something else you did kind of on the side or whatever. And one of the things that has sort of emerged, although not as recently as many people think, I think, is the idea of a novel in stories or these collections of linked stories. And there is an argument to be made that one of the... Oh, you want me to stop? Well, I'll just do this briefly. That one of the argument is that these linked stories are more palatable to publishers because it looks kind of like a novel. So even though they're really separate stories, and I don't know. I mean, Juno, this is something that obviously is sort of pertinent in your case. The idea being that these stories are linked by, for example, a constant narrator, a single narrator, or by a protagonist. Or my favorite example, of course, is Winesburg, Ohio, which is linked by a place, which is an unusual way of doing it and was puzzling to people when it was first published. So I don't know. I mean, is this a, you know, how is this playing in the world of publishing?
The linked short stories? Well, they do seem to be more and more popular.
Yeah. Do you get any pressure to do this? Anybody ever say you should do this, or does it appeal to you as an idea? Or
My stories are linked mainly by the fact that they're all written by the same person.
By you, right. They're already linked. Jennifer?
Well, my new story collection is a linked collection.
Oh, it is?
And like Winesburg, Ohio, it is centered around a place.
Oh, cool.
I did find that my publisher was more interested in the idea of a collection once it was understood that these were linked stories. There was a noticeable warming of the climate at HarperCollins. And my editor said to me, after having read the final manuscript, you know, it really feels like a book. and you know, it was striking me because, of course, you know, it was intended to be a book, and in my mind would still be a book if the stories had nothing at all to do with each other. But it, you know, the model of the novel is really powerful in publishing, and I think there is, you know, there is, I think, a partly mistaken belief that readers don't want short stories. I don't think it's true at all. I think it's sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that publishers believe this, so they don't promote collections of short stories in the way they promote novels. And then, surprise, surprise, the story collections don't sell very much. So I think it is, you know, partly a misreading of popular attitudes.
It's an interesting bias, too, because it's super fascinating. Again, if you're like a totally like love to read, it's super fascinating that like the shibboleths of reading, when you look at some of the stuff they say, it's sort of astonishing to me. I put out this book of short stories, and I can, if I was going to bore you to death and show you like 20 reviews on my work, what's super fascinating is, well, first, 90% of the reviews just want to talk about the language. None of them want to talk about what you're actually doing, the substance of the work. They're like, oh, language. There's Spanish. There's cursing. Oh. Which is like the laziest review on earth. It's like the Obama thing. Oh, Obama speaks so well. Oh, he's so articulate. You know, and it's fascinating. Like, even really good reviews, they're like, oh, Spanish cursing. And then these are people who are supposed to be serious critics, you know? And what's fascinating then the second genre or the second strand in this is this desire, A, that I hadn't written what I'd written. I wish he would write stuff more generous. There's a bigger universe outside of these characters. And then the third element of this laziness is, I don't understand why he went back to stories. Having escaped from that ghetto with the novel. And if you actually filter 90% of the reviews that I had gotten, and I mean, I'm blessed to get reviews at all. You know, you're lucky to get reviews. But if you filter them, that is 95% of what I get. And how often people are like, I hope he writes a novel next time. And these are writers. These are people who supposedly love literature. And if literature has friends like these, we're in serious trouble. If it, as Jennifer pointed out, if it wasn't for readers, one could get very cynical. But readers are these wonderful people where if you put a story out, they come and find it. Because they don't have a critic saying, oh, Jennifer. Oh, Jennifer.
I get that a lot from critics.
No, well, it's astonishing.
The friends of literature.
On that note, we have many friends of literature here, and I think they might want to ask some questions. So are there people who would like to ask questions? And I don't know what the procedure is. Do you come to the mic to ask your question? Be a brave soul. The first brave soul who rises wins arise and come to the mic, since I'm here in the church. come. And maybe other people who have questions want to come sort of so we don't spend, you know, hours while you traipse up and down the, what is this called? The apps or something, that's not right. Hey,
can you hear me?
Yes, I think so.
Excellent. Okay, so I've been hearing a lot and reading a lot about how the internet is changing.
Come here to this one. Come right up here to this one, because we can't understand that. It's like boom, 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 boom. Let's see how this goes.
All right, how's that?
That's good for us.
Excellent. So my name's Jen. I'm a public library librarian. Thank you. Yes. So my question is this. I've been reading a lot lately and hearing a lot about how the internet is changing our brain, and it's changing what we can focus on. We want things very quickly. We want them at our fingertips. It's changing our brain to the point that want to go from one thing to the other really quickly. We want that instant gratification. So I have a two-part question. How is that changing our brains as readers? And how is it affecting, you think, it sounds like from what you guys have said today, there's a big focus in literature today on the short story. It sounds like it's blooming and bursting from what you guys are saying. Do you think in some way the way the internet is changing our brain supposedly is affecting that, that people maybe are moving a bit more towards short stories because it's a smaller chunk to concentrate on rather than a whole novel?
Who wants to take that? Come on.
I'll take it. As I said, I live in the 20th century before the internet, and I don't read the internet, and I don't think it's changing our brain, but I don't know. My brain's the same.
I mean, I teach students. I spend a lot of time with students, and from the research that I read, we're probably reading similar research, and I got a lot of brain cog people at MIT who are really interested in this question. And one of the fun things about with my students is, you know, the brain cog people kind of agree that there seems to be the ability to be addicted to interruption, which is what sort of checking your phone is all about and constantly texting, is that there's an addiction to interruption. And one of the weird things with my students is I kind of have a little contest and see if we can go a full hour in class without any of them like glancing at their phone or doing anything, and it is incredibly difficult for them. Where I feel like, because I grew up in the 20th century partially, my muscles of concentration like are far more advanced than they are. Now, how does this, what does this do for reading? I'm not sure. I'm not a brain cog person. I haven't seen it longitudinally. I mean, it's got to do something.
There's another interesting thing, and if you're a librarian, you'll know this, is that there's a huge rise in the popularity of series. Especially for young people. And the interesting thing about series is that actually they are sustained over hundreds, if not sometimes thousands of words, of pages. So that's kind of contrary to the whole idea that people need constant, you know, short doses of this, that, and the other. Anyway, just a thought. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I just want to ask a very uncomplicated question about endings. How do you know your story has ended? Do you have an ending in mind when you feel the impulse to write the short story? And whatever you can tell us about endings.
Go ahead.
I have an ending in mind when I begin a short story. It's invariably dropped at some point, and the ending changes. I know when I have finished a short story when it is time to visit my writing partner, who will read this short story and tell me what she thinks of it. So I have a built-in finale. If she doesn't like it much, I go through the process again. But she is actually the place where I stop when I have an appointment with her.
And reading helps, too, in the sense that, you know, when you work with young people or with young writers, if you've only read, like, 20 or 30 stories, a lot of my young writers are like, how do I end a story? You read, like, 2,000 stories? And, well, no, the actual form helps to guide what would be an effective, a successful ending. You know, it interacts with your own desires, with your own plans, and with the story. And I remember when I first started reading short stories, my ideas of beginning and endings were not all that great. They were like mostly from TV. And then by the time I had read 2,000 short stories, intuitively, that information was a really great help, you know? And that's mostly what people don't want to hear. Like, read a lot more, and it'll help you. But it does help tremendously. And my guide tends to be, I know an ending is very successful if I've built the Eden of the story well enough so that when the angels of that final period evict the reader from it, they'll feel something, some kind of like, wow, I wish I was still here. But if the Eden of the story is too weak, when the angel comes and sets up the flaming sword, they're like, thank God. You know?
Well, you know, I think that's very well said, that it's reading short stories that teaches you how they're shaped. And it's something that you sort of understand on a molecular level at a certain point when you've read enough of them. And it's, I don't think there's any other way to learn how to do that, except by looking at people who do it well and the people who do it badly. You learn from good writing and from bad writing both.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Next question.
Yes, my question is on repeating things. I've seen in a few novels and a few short stories, and people have a plethora of work, that there'll be a theme or a concept, something they mentioned before, that they'll repeat again and refashion, or sometimes do it again, over again. What do you think that does when you refashion it, add something new, add something different, and add more depth to it, or take more depth away? What do you think that does for you as a writer and for the readers as well?
Can you repeat this?
Repetition inside of the story. When somebody repeats a theme or an image or a set of circumstances again,
yes,
over various works, and you're asking, what do you think that does for both readers and for the writer?
Yes, sir.
Difficult question.
Across multiple different works, you mean,
yeah,
not just inside a certain story?
Well, sometimes it's also within a certain story. So sometimes people will just keep on recycling something.
Well, one of the things it does, it gives the reviewers something to talk about.
I wish we would talk less about them.
You brought them up.
But
do you,
you know,
mean iteration with a difference each time?
Well, sometimes there's a difference, but sometimes it will just be exactly the same, except
do
maybe...
Do you have a specific case? Because that'll help us.
I'll use... Actually, your new collection compared to...
Damn. I was hoping it was going to be them two.
Compared to the brief, wondrous life of Oscar Wilde. Lola, for example, or also within your collection, two things sort of recycle at the same step. The special woman in your life, or the special woman that the character Junior loses in the life, is lost. It's Lola and Oscar Wilde, and then it is the Mujeron and the new collection.
Who's actually Lola.
Who's actually Lola again, but we never get to mention her name.
Well, go on, I'm sorry.
And I just want to see what that effect gives, because there's different things that change between two. One thing, the actual identification of the woman is Indian, then it becomes Guyanese. Then the circumstances change as well, because it's less based in sort of the collegiate setting, but the collegiate setting is in the background in the other one, and it's more depth compared to less depth, and there's depth in different areas.
Okay.
And I get different feelings from each of them.
I'm just going to, before we get too deep in this, do you want to give it a go?
I mean, I'm not sure I can address the question exactly, because it's sort of part of a conversation and less of a simple intervention from an author. I certainly think that as a writer, you're fighting. Listen, I've got to convince someone that they're in a world based on a bunch of chicken scratches on paper. And often what's really helpful is taking parallax views, where you can look at one thing one way and then look at it from a different way in another story, and it helps give a sense that they're in a more three-dimensional space, a reader. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I think that there's a part of us, and again, I can't explain for everybody, but sometimes as an artist, you're basically called to draw fruit for 20 years. And, you know, you repeat yourself sometimes because that's what you're called to do, and it's hard to escape it. Yeah? I mean, I don't know if I can answer it better than that.
That's good.
Anyone I'm sorry.
Nick, are you giving me... I can't...
I think we have to take another question.
Last question, sorry.
Sorry.
Wrong glasses. Okay, one more question.
Hi, I'm a bookseller who loves short stories, so I'm really excited to see this huge room full of people for a short story panel. I just want to say that first. But my question is pretty short. I'm wondering how you deal with ordering in your story collections and the importance of that, the order of stories.
Edith,
the order within a book, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
In my recent book, I was helped by a bunch of graduate students who were working on my book for the publisher, so they suggested some various orders. I switched them around. The only thing I can tell you particularly is that the first story was selected because it was short enough to be read standing up in a bookstore.
For me, I enjoy very much the game with the reader, not a game as a manipulation, but a game of play. And there's a part of me that deeply desires my reader at some level to engage in the composition of the book with me. And when they finish it, they have to reorder the stories in the way they want to. And that depending on how you reorder the stories, you reorder the events, depending on how you recollect the book, it forms a very different book for each person. And in this case, when I ordered these stories, even though the stories jump in time and they jump in place, there's actually a couple of thematic things that are moving through that helped me, and I needed to order them. The main character, Junior, has this crazy problem with intimacy, and he tries to use his body as a way to not deal with the stuff of his life. You know, he tries to like become a big muscle-bound dude. And what I really wanted to have through the story is watch how this strategy of using his body to avoid intimacy slowly breaks down. And as you read the stories, his body slowly declines. And at the end, his body breaks down completely. That helped me order.
I love this question. I think it's terribly interesting. As somebody who's been writing short stories for a lot of years and never collected them in a book, I was astonished to see what an opportunity that is. You know, these stories have lives of their own. They mean something individually. And yet, by ordering them in a particular way, you're sort of creating a conversation from one story to the next. You know, the third story in my collection reads differently because of what comes immediately before it. If you read it on its own without reference to the others, it's a different thing. So it's an additional opportunity to sort of, there's the story between the story, you know, the resonance between the first, the second, the third.
But I must add that you cannot depend on the reader to read your stories in the order that they're presented to him. He may skip around.
Quite. Well, I think we have to wrap it up, but I want to, first of all, thank you all for coming out. The Boston Book Festival is a really important part of the Boston literary scene, and we're really happy that it happens and delighted to see such a great big audience. We're going to have a book signing, so for those of you, where will that be? In the tent.
Right behind here.
That way.
Okay, thanks.